What I will be talking about, well, I'll start off really by saying I try to provide a little bit of contextual kind of reference here. Firstly, to say very briefly about myself, whilst I've been working in University College Cork for the last 20 odd years, I am, however, from Shankill Road and influenced as much as anybody growing up throughout the Troubles in the Shankill Road would be in terms of their cultural identity, if you want to call it cultural baggage or whatever. So, to some extent, my experience in Cork in the context of working in an area of social studies in a university has been an interesting and challenging one for me, and no doubt for my colleagues at times as well. I mention this because it has some bearing in some of the points I'm going to try and tease out here today in relation to how Northern Protestants, Northern Unionists, Northern Nationalists are perceived by people in the Republic, and also because I think it's relevant that certainly one of the most revelatory experiences that I had since moving to the Republic was the depth of partitionist feeling from citizens in the South towards the North in general, it must be said. Whilst that may not be, it may be surprising to some people from the Protestant Unionist culture who have been brought up obviously in an understanding that they just can't wait to get their hands on us and so on and so forth. What I found to be particularly surprising was, and in a way particularly offensive, I would imagine, to some of my contemporaries, one of whom comes from a Northern Nationalist background and had actually, as a matter of public record, served time for crimes that he carried out as part of the IRA campaign in England. He came from West Belfast. He arrived down to take up a position in my department and was staggered at the sense of suspicion and mistrust and general hostility that was extended towards him as someone who was representative of the Nationalist Republican community in Northern Ireland. So these kind of stereotypes and these kind of expectations that we might harbour in regards to these traditional ideas of what Southern Nationalists might think of Northern Protestants and indeed Northern Catholics, I think are open to debate, are open to further kind of investigation, because I think in doing so it may open up some opportunities that I'll refer to later on. Structurally, as far as, excuse me for turning around every now and again to try and make these slides work. Yeah, there we go. Really, where my input from this came onto the radar for this particular session was that, as Andy had mentioned, Gareth Mulvaney and myself had been putting together a book provisionally entitled No One Likes Us, We Don't Care. Some of you may be familiar with that line. It originates, I think, from Millwall football fans who, and indeed Rangers, Glasgow Rangers as well, who take a kind of a sort of inverted snobbery pride in the fact that no one likes them and they don't care. And there's a certain arrogance in that, obviously. And there are echoes, I think, to some extent, in that and in how Protestants, certainly the loyalist community, are perceived in the wider kind of scheme of things, certainly and sometimes represented, most of the time represented by popular media and popular press and so on, as a group who quite simply are locked into the certainty of their own cultural identity and have little or no interest in anybody else or any other manifestation of how people might see them and so on. So, I that was the initial instigation behind this book. And we thought we'd take a kind of scattergun approach, if you like, in regards to inviting people to contribute to it. When we sat down and actually thought what this might consist of, it became apparent that, if you're trying to deconstruct a culture, even one as supposedly monolithic as the Ulster Unionist, Loyalist, Protestant culture, you find that it's not monolithic at all, of course, as I'm sure pretty much everybody in the room realises, in terms of religious, historical, denominational, political aspirations, so on and so forth, class, of course, so many different variants that are feeding into the notion of what actually constitutes an identity, a collective identity for this particular community. So to try and take that on board to some extent, what we did was we had a kind of a scattergun approach to who we would ask and what we would ask them to do for this particular collection. And so we have this isn't a plug for the book, by the way. It just is necessary to give some kind of chronological context to what I'm supposed to talk about today. So basically, you'll see from the people who are involved here and the areas that they're looking at, it's really quite diverse. You'll recognise people like Owen Harris and Henry McDonald, Brian Kennaway, Malachy O'Doherty. All these people are bringing, to some extent, and also in the writing styles, it's quite an eclectic kind of thing because they're bringing different writing styles and different perceptions. We deliberately asked people like Malachy O'Doherty to talk about the Northern Nationalist experience of this community. We also asked Owen Harris to talk about the Southern Nationalist expectations community, and you know, lots of interesting things emerged from this. And I'm going to pick out some of those today, some of those that resonated with me, if you like, most dramatically, and suggested to me that there may be a potential development in trying to break through this, impasse of that this community seems to find itself in and has found itself in for some time. What I'm going to suggest to you isn't in any way original. It is, however, quite radical, and certainly I'm sure people will have opinions as to its workability or even as to its desirability to a large degree. But we'll get there as we move through. Of course, another significant thing that happened when we were trying to put this book together and solicit essays from people and so on was the Flags protest and the acceleration of incidents, whether they be around the funding of the maize development, the Flag protest itself. All of these kind of high profile nerves were touched within this community, and it had obviously a knock on effect that's still with us today. I mean, we've just learned in the last few days that there's going to be a big protest that the Parades Commission have okayed in the run up to Christmas and so on, which is going to have many ramifications. I mean, already storekeepers and so on of central Belfast are probably rightly concerned how it's going to affect their trade. So all of the issues pertaining to the right of this community to voice its concerns about what it sees as the greening, if you like, of post-conflict Northern Ireland, or the de-Britification, I think is a term that Gareth used, of post-conflict Northern Ireland, and their concerns around that. It's really what is driving or underpinning what I'm talking about today, and how we're actually going to address that, how it's going to be dealt with. Is it a justified concern? Are these things happening? And of course, at this point, this is where the term culture wars becomes relevant, because for many of this community, they firmly believe that they are in a culture war. They believe that the postscript to the conflict is one where there's an argument, a struggle for hearts and minds, nationally, internationally, in regards to what the future of this particular part of the island should be, both in terms of its political allegiance, but also more significantly, because they're obviously very closely tied up, in relation to cultural identity, expressions of this particular geographical area, in terms of their Britishness, their Irishness, and so on and so forth, and their aspiration in time to, where this region might be going. So the stakes are high. And if you do buy into the notion, I mean, maybe you disagree with it, which is perfectly fine, but for the moment, indulge me and buy into the notion that this community might have genuine concerns in this regard. Then you'll begin to understand the depth, of feeling, and also, the levels of fear that might maybe exist there. It's worth saying as well, of course, that these fears might exist in different strata within this community. The bourgeoisie of South Belfast or East Belfast, to some extent, may represent their fears very differently. They won't be the people who will be down on the protest, of course. But as always, historically, with this community, the middle classes have, to a large degree, been quite happy to allow people to go out onto the streets, tacitly declaiming them and tacitly kind of rejecting them, but quite happy that maybe they're there, actually carrying out some service that might be necessary to keep wider concerns that are going on stated maybe amongst political classes in regards to these issues around culture, cultural wars and so on and so forth. Again, that's something I think that's worth talking about. Let me take you right back for a moment into a situation that some of my colleagues may be familiar with this particular incident, but I will take you into it. It was involved a dinner party that I attended not so long ago in Cork City, and I'll just paraphrase it. Actually, I've drawn from that to make up the preface of the book that I've been talking to you about, and I just very briefly I've paraphrased some of it, and I'll just very briefly go through that with you to give you an idea, if you like, what some of the issues informing the book and informing today's talk, and maybe to some extent informing other contributions that will come after me today. Basically, as I say, I think some of the issues that I'm going to suggest to you now that came up in this conversation are fairly typical of the kind of problems that we're facing. So, whilst attending a perfectly respectable dinner party in the second city of Ireland, the post-espresso-fueled topic of conversation turned to, of all things, the validity of cultural expression. After close on 20 years as a tax-paying citizen of the Republic, I am, it seems, for good or ill, forever to be designated as the prod from Belfast. An unpleasant trait often associated with Cork, whereby anyone sojourning deep into the heart of the so-called rebel county will forever be considered a blow-in, no matter how long their duration of domicile. As such, I can anticipate, as I so often have done before, what was coming straight down the tracks at me. Didn't I believe that those aspects of triumphalism inherent within the core of Northern Orangeism undoubtedly stymied initiatives such as the much-lambasted Orange Fest? It was not unreasonably posited that this legacy would inevitably scupper any attempt to move towards a more inclusive mainstream carnival-like 12th of July celebration aimed at promoting those positive aspects of Protestant loyalist or unionist cultural identity. And it required only a small leap of lazy stereotyping then to press forward with the inevitable premise. At this point, a young woman with impeccable Irish Republican credentials spoke up forcefully and advanced her sure and certain hypothesis that there did not exist, neither could there ever exist, any legitimate or worthwhile expression of a valid or meaningful cultural contribution emerging from the Ulster Unionist or Loyalist tradition. She cited as her logic for this pronouncement that, unlike, say, the great Protestant poets, playwrights and novelists who embellished the literary history of the Republic, no repressive sectarian or reactionary state could ever produce art or cultural expression of worthwhile or lasting merit. As if by way of empirical evidence, a quick inventory was offered. An entire pantheon of outstandingly successful musicians, writers and actors were presented, all of them first or second generation Catholic Irish, and many of them drawing their very inspiration from the muse of Celtic mysticism, Catholicism, dispossession and suffering. To further support this, she asked us to consider if any enduring and influential artist had emerged from apartheid African society, the Zionist Israeli state, or indeed Nazi Germany for that matter. No great art in general, and edgy, subversive popular culture in particular, remained exclusively the unimpeachable birthright of the dispossessed, the revolutionary and the freedom fighter. And woe betide anyone from the liberal intelligentsia who might dare to suggest otherwise. I forced a smile, of course, through gritted teeth, feeling that any spur of the defence on the matter would render me a bellicose Paisleyite and monarchist lickspittle once I left the room, naturally. So, is that how other people see us? Does no one like us? Do we not care? That, in essence, is what I'm proposing to talk about today. This sense of being disregarded echoes Henry MacDonald's premise that this is, quote, the least fashionable community in Western Europe. Here we begin to find the Protestant reflection of the Catholic mope syndrome, that is, the most oppressed people ever. In contradistinction, Ulster Protestants are perhaps suffering from the mute syndrome. The most unfashionable people ever. At least in their own minds. However, the reality is that in post-Good Friday Agreement Ireland, Ulster Protestants are not even significant enough to be unfashionable. You don't have to look very hard to find far more unpopular groups. Roma or Albanians, for example, in European popular consciousness. The real issue here, I think, for Protestants is not that no one likes them, it's that nobody cares. And that, as I say, is at the heart of where the problem, I think, lies. And specifically, nobody cares, most hurtfully, if you like, for this community, nobody cares from their natural hinterland, the British establishment. There's a metropolitan colonial tension, a sense of being the ones who make the sacrifice for Britishness at the frontiers, whilst those in Whitehall regard us with metropolitan disdain. In the famous Rudyard Kipling quote, "What do they know of England who only England know?" There may well be something in the notion that the British reaction to the Flags protest is rooted in the fact that it represents the purest form of British nationalism, the logic of imperialist nationalism. In other words, British distaste for loyalism is a form of displacement that confirms their self-image of tolerance and multiculturalism. This helps keep repressed all the nastier aspects of nationalism lurking behind, for example, the Olympic Fest. In this sense, Orange Fest isn't that far removed, say, from London 2012 or the last night of the proms. But this only compounds the Ulster Protestant sense of grievance, namely that they have the party, but we are the sacrifice. Anybody know this fellow? You see, when the loyalist community tries to articulate these kinds of concerns, this is very often what happens. This is what comes out. Okay? The Taser Fraser, who, as if you don't know, had decided to dress himself up as Adam Hanza and appear in public. You know, obviously he went to some length to make the point. But again, you know, amongst anyone taking their politics seriously, this is laughable. And this really goes hand in hand with one of the problems that this community is facing, locked as they are into this stereotypical image of how outsiders see them and how they present themselves and how they present their concerns. Very often they do so in a way that is counterproductive, obviously. Some other images, perhaps, that are resonant and that will come to people's attention, people may be familiar with, but nonetheless are arguably counterproductive to the concerns of this community. This was the recent UVF memorial ceremony that we had, and whilst I think it's quite legitimate for something like this to take place, I think it's historically relevant, I think it's just as relevant as a 1916 occasion that we're going to be seeing a lot of, I imagine, over the next coming months and year. Nevertheless, it still holds within it aspects, obviously, of triumphalism, of looking backwards, of defence of what we have, we hold, and so on and so forth. So again, it has these negative resonances that are consistent with how this community represents itself, and that's worrying. That's Billy Hutchison, by the way, who is a contributor to our book, and who I took a lot of delight in telling him recently that actually that outfit made him look like the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang. This is my favourite image. All these images, by the way, went out in popular press. They would have all been well seen, you know, and again would be consistent with how people would see this community when this community tries to articulate its problems. This is my favourite one, because it kills so many birds with one stone. This was taken at the Twaddell Avenue protest, and which I'm sure you're familiar with. If Russell Brand is familiar with it, I'm sure you're familiar with it. Let's kill several birds with one stone. We have Robert Buxom Lady here, who's out on protest, who's holding a piece of artwork by Michael Stone, no less, that famous conceptual artist who tried to blow up Stormont as a sort of artistic statement. And there's an elderly orange man who's obviously at the site showing his support as well, thinking about purchasing, it would seem, thinking about purchasing this piece of work. You know, how many stereotypes and cliches can you cram into one shot? I just thought this one was particularly resonant. Another problem, of course, we have came up there not so long ago, the issue of wall murals. And this is an interesting one for me because it also relates to the idea of sports. Sports is never very, very far away in this country from cultural identity and expressions of cultural identity. And you only have to look at association football or rugby or Gaelic or any of the main sports to see the fissures of these kind of cultural extremes articulating themselves in many respects. And ownership of sports and ownership of sporting heroes and so on is very important in this country, north and south. One only has to think of the whole situation that arose from Rory McIlroy daring to say that he might play golf for Great Britain in the coming Olympics. This was an issue in point. I, at the time, would have this would have came onto my radar in court, and I was taken aback at how appalled my colleagues in court were that Rory McIlroy, a Northern Catholic, would have taken the soup in this regard. How could he play for them? And again, it suggested to me levels of mistrust and historical levels of antagonism towards the British, and by extension then those who call themselves British on the island, held by large swathes of policymaking, middle class, well-educated Republic of Ireland citizens. So the reason I'm saying that is because it's something I'm going to come back to, which is to say that whilst Northern Protestants certainly do celebrate their difference, they have difference thrust upon them as well. So the George Best mural, as you're probably familiar with, again very damagingly was replaced with this. The UVF, who put up this mural, and it's significant I included this because obviously, as you'll be aware, the language has changed. Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor, it must be demanded by the oppressed. Suddenly this community are now the oppressed. They're trying to wear the clothes, as you're probably aware, of their nationalist Republican counterparts who historically had the role of being the oppressed and so on. And this is a discourse, a narrative that is trying to be promoted by this community at the time with varying degrees of success. Okay. Nevertheless, this would be the image that would have gone out in the national press and so on, that George Best, the sporting hero, was now replaced by a paramilitary icon, moved back into the past and so on. Politics makes strange bedfellows. Strangely, this culture, this community, and their cultural identity and expressions of their cultural identity has found some strange areas or unexpected areas of support. Good old Grayson Perry has actually come out and said, quote, that Orange Order parades have enjoyed something like a capital. Turner Prize winner Grayson Perry calling them powerfully dark examples of folk art. Interesting. Okay, so all of this and all of these issues are taking place against the backdrop of the flags protest that hasn't gone away, of course. And as I've said to you earlier, it's about to rear its ugly head again. So, can we learn anything from the flags protest? And when it first hit our streets, which would have been about a year ago,
About a year ago.
Yeah. So, is there anything we've learned since in the interim period? Gareth, if he doesn't mind me paraphrasing him here, I said, one of the trends which emerged on Twitter throughout the first week or so of the flag protests was the use of the hashtag entitled flags, i.e. hashtag flags. This play on the perceived pronunciation of the word flag by working class loyalists became an integral part of the discourse used by many people on Twitter. Indeed, flags entered the wider lexicon and was used by journalists and others. So what, says you? Well, the narrative following the flags controversy is that Sinn Féin is involved in a cultural war on Protestants and that their intent is to decritify Belfast. The use of colloquialisms such as flags and continuing reference to the protesters' attire of sports and leisure clothing demonstrated an obvious contempt for the loyalist socio-economic background. The journalist Eamon McCann, the Derry journalist Eamon McCann, tackled the issue in the Belfast Telegraph in the second week of January last, stating, flags is the word, not flags. Much as a number of commentators seem to relish the chance to sneer at a section of the less well-off without fear of being labelled offensive. Now, many of those who sneered, of course, were fellow Protestants, Ulster, Unionists, loyalists and so on. Again, accentuating a very significant fissure that still remains within this collective community cultural identity, which is one of class. And some extent related education, but education in terms of social mobility, class, and so on and so forth. So, it's been oft stated that Protestant Unionist and Loyalist cultural expression defines itself in terms of separatism, exclusivity, exceptionalism, arrogance, and perceived elitism. Notions of a labour aristocracy and so on, that Jim would certainly be familiar with, and has written about. Which I think no longer exists since the decline of traditional industries and so on, and hasn't existed for some time. The implication being that collaboration and common purpose with shared expressions of Irishness through cultural alignment are eschewed by this community. Okay, so what I'm suggesting to you is that, you know, engage with this community and you will immediately run up against this notion, this diametrically opposed dichotomy of Irishness and Britishness. That to be British is not to be Irish and vice versa. Okay? And all of the blame, subsequently, for that stance is traditionally laid at the feet of this community. That they do not want to be Irish. They want no part of Irishness. And so on and so on. And that would be, you know, sort of, they're seen as the intransigent ones, they're seen as the closed off ones, they're seen as the backward looking ones, and so on. I'm saying, however, that when we review responses from the nationalist tradition within Northern Ireland and the Republic towards this community, we can clearly and easily identify a partitionist mistrust, even antagonism, anchored within a deeper perception of difference. Protestants, Unionists, Loyalists may indeed harbour solemn reservations regarding their Irishness. Crucially, however, this is seriously compounded by nationalist opinion that seemingly rejects any expression or representation of Irishness that does not subscribe to a devalorian idol. Loyalist, Protestant, Unionist communities should be able to meaningfully re-engage with those unique characteristics that previously identified them as different and distinctive within their shared British family, namely their Irishness. To be Welsh, to be Scottish, to be Irish. In order for them to do this, Irish cultural identity must be seen to denote more than simply the Catholic, nationalist, Republican, monolithic tradition. From a policy-making perspective, we cannot underestimate the potency of partitionist separatist opinion in the Republic of Ireland in this regard. And at the sharper end of things, from those Northern nationalists who relentlessly seek cultural domination and the eradication of British culture from Northern Ireland. Put simply, if Ulster Protestants did not already feel significantly different to their neighbours, then difference would most certainly be thrust upon them. That no one likes us because we often have unlikable politics, and racism and sectarianism is only part of this, may be an unpalatable truth for many Protestants. Ultimately, however, recognising that our politics are based on choice is profoundly liberating. Politics aren't hardwired culturally or genetically. The choices made since the United Irish movement have often been reactionary and self-destructive for this community. And all this leads to the broad conclusion that only a reconnection with Irish and Irish Protestant identity offers a way out of this morass. To quote Rabbi McVeigh, Ulster Protestant identity didn't really exist until the 20th century. While the roots of the partition of nine county Ulster unionism from Irish unionism lie in the Ulster Defence Union, formed to oppose the Second Home Rule Bill in 1893, there was no clearly distinct Ulster unionism until 1905. Before that, Protestants in Ireland, like their churches, were Irish. Unionists were Irish and Loyalists and Orangemen were Irish, organising and belonging to all Ireland institutions. Theirs was an Irish identity profoundly sensitive to its defining features, its privilege and its minority status. So, let me try and round things off. And as I said to you right at the start, I'm not suggesting or offering anything here that's original, but certainly is radical. Protestant Unionist Loyalists need to reclaim their Irishness, in a nutshell. To challenge this mutually exclusive dichotomy of Britishness and Irishness. To refute the exclusivity of Irishness as uniquely Catholic or nationalist. To re-embrace a sense of Irish identity previously accepted within a UK context, i.e. before partition. Now, I would have to say here that this is where my colleague Robbie McVeigh would differ from me here, because he agrees with this analysis of a move back towards a sense of only an Irish identity or Irishness again, but he sees it politically within ultimately an all-Ireland solution. I don't. Certainly not in the immediate future. So my whereas we have the same goal, if you like, you know, how we get there would be quite different. So I'm saying this community needs to find acceptable ways to integrate this identity in terms of flags and emblems. And all of the above, essentially a rejection of the devalorian code of Irish identity, would expose the existing conditional stance of Sinn Féin and the Republic of Ireland government that to be a member of the UK is incompatible with being Irish. So, does this community have the courage or the vision for such a step? As the late David Irvine said, how the hell can you not be Irish when you're born and reared and all things affect you on the island of Ireland? So, more questions than answers, but thank you very much for your time.